This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Conceptualizing the series, Aaron and I decided to come up with a text or a sort of almost theatric preamble to each one of the events to set the stage and open the space of the conversation. And in looking at this event, we thought about a historical parallel to our own time, to the very changing and ephemeral nature of both intellectual and artistic practice that we're seeing today as finding a parallel in the 17th century and the tremendous heterotrope and heterogeneous realm of activity that was going on in Europe at that time. And we've chosen as an opening gesture, which is nothing but a metaphoric preamble to this conversation. Jean-Michel and Bob are not going to be responding to this per se. We are simply going to put it out there for your listening pleasure. We're going to play a reading of a brief treatise on the echo from the early 17th century. The text is a very curious one. The author is French. He wrote the piece in the early 1620s, the best of our estimation. The text appeared as a manuscript in the correspondence of Marin Mersenne, one of the great polymathic intellectuals of 17th century France, very well known in the history of science and for his advances in mathematics. The treatise appears during a time where Mersenne was researching the echo as part of the development of the first theory of spatial acoustics. He modeled his theory of spatial acoustics after Cartesian optics. He was attempting to derive a rigorous science of acoustics from optics and felt that a great deal of advancement could be gained in studying the phenomenon of the echo. So there was this tremendous growth and bloom of writing and speculation on the echo. In this work, we find the echo characterized as a sort of femme fatale, a duplicitous and very devious female figure, often no offense to the ladies in the audience, but that was the metaphor that they often wrote about the echo in a poetic sense. And this text that you're about to hear in recording is written very much in the style of the kind of heterogeneous speculation and collection of quotation and thought and experiment that you find in the writings of, say, Bacon and Montaigne. So it's very curious. It goes back and forth between quotation and speculation and is relatively stream of consciousness in its structure. Let's see, what else on this text? The nature of the speculation that goes on in this text, as you will hear, it goes back and forth between the echo as a completely transient and ephemeral phenomenon. And one of the most significant things, I think, about it is that it ends completely unresolved. The author basically admits defeat at the end of the text and leaves his investigation to somebody greater and more advanced after him. And I think that the nature of the conversations that we have here are so wonderful in that they are open-ended and are not necessarily purposed to coming to a conclusion, but simply discoursing about the topic at hand. So without any further ado, we'll play you an excerpt from our anonymous treatise. The author is unknown, called A Particular Treatise on the Echo from 1626.
I am reminded of the promise that I made you upon my departure from Paris in October 1625, and I have, at long last, finally compelled myself to fulfill my obligations to whatever end I am able. But considering the fugitive nature and the obscurity of the echo, nymph of the air, daughter of Juno, Naiad, Dryad, or Oread, please excuse me for not having excised from her the rent that is due to me for her residing over the woods, distant lands, gardens, houses, and mountains. For this delinquent debtor often leaves the home so she may say that she wasn't there. This has tormented her creditor for an entire month, as I have searched ceaselessly for her morning, noon, night, through good and bad times, lying in constant waiting for the occasion to speak with her. This nymph employs her knowledge of the extensive routes connecting the woods, river valleys, ponds, islands, caves, churches, bell towers, roads and city walls, wells, barnyards, smoke pits, presses, courtyards, canals, aqueducts, openings below the earth, bowers, plaster vaults, shacks, large spaces such as ports, arcades, portals, bridges, outcroppings of rocks, banks of columns, and high mountains. All that I might be able to learn about the Echo would amount to nothing more than the vague assurance and knowledge a mariner might derive from the tremblings of his compass as he searches for new worlds. There are two possible methods of approach to researching the nature of this image of the voice, namely investigation of its practical operation or engagement in theoretical and philosophical speculation. But I recognize that I must leave the attainment of this goal to another Pan, that is to say, to a man more polymathic than I, who is possessed of all kinds of other knowledge, capable of trapping this Fanthea. She flees into her hiding place and vanishes before our eyes. He who assumes this challenge must dedicate his entire life to the relentless pursuit of her, even into her very bedroom, into her den. The path or environment of the sound dampens or accelerates the movements of the Echo, and the initial percussive of air created by the collision of two hard objects bears enough witness to the fact that sound is not a simple accident, but rather a substance, which is not always the same in dimension or nature, since it always represents a different tone. She is always morphing and changing based on the disposition and shape of the islands, small riverbanks, marshy ditches, rivulets, grassy fields, all of which disguise her sound, like a mirror that has been tinted with a certain color, imposing a certain affect onto every image that it reflects. Concerning the size and length of the vocal line of the Echo, I find that in order to hear clearly a two-syllable word, it is necessary to be a distance of 25 meters from the point of reflection, and that the space not be open or ill-defined, but rather enclosed by a ditch or a wall. I encountered an Echo at 100 geometric feet, this one quite weak, as it propagated itself along the roads through the underbrush, hedgerows, old sheds, and cottages, here and there, in no determinate order, through the trees, palisades, gardens, and deep holes, at last finding refuge in the narrow corner of two joining walls supported from behind by an embankment. The sound echoes briefly but distinctly 4, 5, 6, and 7 syllables, such as those in the words and phrases Kolentampon, Abdenago, Lemeravacan, Paraferagaramus, Arma Lirumque, Kano. It travels a distance of 120 geometric feet, at which point one must mount a small hilltop of 3 or 4 feet in order to hear it. Otherwise, it becomes quiet, mute, entirely inaudible. Our science of echoes, our echometrie, has an advantage not found anywhere else, not even in the science of optics, namely that echoes have the ability not only to be transmitted through diaphanous materials, but also through entirely opaque materials. Someone else who has more leisure time than I might be able to understand the parallels between optics and echometrie and be able to prepare a theory that outlines the relationships between both fields. But I am content for the moment to draw on the thought of Averroa, who tells us that the nature of the echo is like the circles that are produced in water when one casts a small stone into a pond. One water particle touches another and impresses the circular figure of the stone into adjacent particles until the wave reaches the shore. At the same time, another wave returns to the place where the rock entered the water. If we consider the sciences of dioptics and catoptics, we find a strong correlation between light rays and the sonic rays that constitute the echo, from those that are cut off or interrupted to those that pass through and over solid bodies to those that are reflected. But to create an echo, it is necessary to possess a sufficiently forceful voice, whose sound, after having resounded here and there, returns to its point of origin, if not by the same sonic path, then at least by one within the same general area of the person who initiated it. It is these ideas concerning sound that I believe Aristotle discusses in his second book on the passions, where he describes a resonant body as being like an open vase, able to receive any kind of contact, or like a ball that has been thrown against a solid object and returns to a place near to that from which it was thrown. It is a similar kind of shock or collision of air that creates a sound capable of inciting panic in foreigners. As Polyanus writes in his Strategemes, Posianus said, the Megarenes supposedly gave to Diane the title of guardian of the Echo. The Persians terrorized the Greeks through an unrelenting echo that lasted an entire night. The Greeks, believing that they were hearing the enemy responding with moans and cries, attacked a giant resonant outcropping of rock only to find no enemy. This sapped all of their fury and courage. The next day, many were taken captive by the Persians, and the others fled to Thebes via Mardonius, and upon their arrival, recounted the terrifying effects of the duplicitous echo. However, that which inspires fear in one man may give pleasure to another, who may find utility in the echo, as in the case of music or its employ in techniques for amplifying the voice so one doesn't have to shout. Interest in this collision of air has endured over the ages. It has long proven an interest of poets who have elevated the concept of the echo to rarefied climes, personifying it, calling it daughter of the air, a fugitive nymph, a savage, a vagabond, a mocker, a vocal masquerader, a deigning respondent, plaintive, mournful, all descriptions inspired by the diversity of impressions and forms that the echo may assume. Along this line, the particular affects of the echo are better studied in the repetition of syllables in which A and O are found than those in which E, I, and U are found, owing to the fact that it is simply easier for the person speaking to form various configurations of the mouth and to vary the force of air with which the vowels A and O are spoken. The nature of the place in which the echo occurs contributes greatly to the knowledge we are seeking. Since the echo can occur anywhere from plaster vaults to niches at the edges of gardens, bowers, resonant churches, arcades, and great bridges spanning rivers, to grottos, niches in walls, woods thick with underbrush, thatched cottages, gardens, palisades, islands covered with willows, and the ruts and gulches near ponds. The ingenious architect builds a place for the echo in his plans for a garden or landscape in order to take advantage of the echo's qualities and effects, as exemplified in the architecture of the Gallery of Olympus and the Seven Towers of Byzantium. Returning to the poets once more, they speak of the echo as a nymph transported by despair, who, against all pleading, is transformed into a rock as her blood is evaporated by the incendiary cruelty of Narcissus. Her body hardens into rock and her stomach opens to become a cavern, all for simply obeying her passions for another. This is testimony to the seductive nature that drives men to seek out and pursue her. She promenaded her wares over the waters and cast liberally her charms, whose magical attributes tormented Narcissus and all whom she scorned.
Thank you. And I think thank you for this beautiful reading of a text that I think Thaddeus discovered and that is not extremely well known.
Well, I should say, though, just in for honesty in reporting here, that when Thaddeus is going to, he's actually going to offer this original manuscript for bid at the end of the talk, and I would like to caution the bidders that, you know, it's a very charming piece, but on the other hand, I think your price that you're willing to pay for it should be conditioned by the fact that this is obviously a 21st century pastiche of something that, you know, purports to be the 16th century in France. So just calibrate your bids accordingly. I mean, it's worth something. It's a charming piece as it is, but you know, don't let the signs of age on the manuscript or that kind of thing sway your bid.
Yes, I think we want in an ecolalic fashion to warn you against imitations, duplications, and forgeries. And I think this is how we started on this idea that we could have a discussion. First of all, maybe to break the danger of a theories ecolalia when one speaks to oneself and you hear words echo. And I think this is one of the things that gave theory, especially French theory, a bad name in the States, that it looks like so much of it is just repetition in a sort of empty space. But at least that's what we wanted to do, and we don't know what the other is going to say. And in order to open up for something new and unpredictable, perhaps, but at least we knew that we had two projects that were not at all identical, but that could overlap. And the fact that Bob was finishing a book on literary frauds, fakes, pastiches, and that he has taught and worked on these writers for a while, that I personally was just finishing a book on lies, or the idea of lying. We thought, okay, this is something that must find a point of convergence, and I think perhaps we can begin with this suspicion that we had this text, and indeed we were wondering, is it a real text, is it a fake? My own case, it was obviously a way, and I think this is similar for Bob, or maybe you let me know, to move from literature to issues like politics, simply. And I'd like to say that my book is written in French and will be published in French, and I'm not sure whether I want to have it in English as such, because it begins by saying simply that this is a book about lies, therefore this is a book about the United States. I'm not sure how well that would fare in this country. At least this is an opening sentence that I might have to rewrite.
Well, it's interesting. Literature and poetry especially, on the one hand, is made up of lies, frauds, imaginings, the imaginary, and it's a texture that goes back millennia. You know, Plato called the poets liars, and then Aristotle would say, no, poetry is more philosophic, therefore more true than history, since it's more general, and history is just contingent. And these arguments raged for millennia, and Sidney tried to resolve it by saying the poet affirms nothing and therefore never lies. So on the one hand, I mean, it's a truism that poetry is full of eschews verisimilitude and eschews the self-identical statement. But on the other hand, thinking about, I think both Aaron and Thaddeus are interested in the relation of the duplicitous to institutions. It's one thing to say that, well, yes, poets are charming liars or fakers. And in recent times, there's this long, rich history of such things. Fernando Pessoa and his heteronyms, his four different imaginary people that he wrote under, Jack Spicer writing an imaginary dialogue to the dead poet Fernando Lorca. There's many examples of these kinds of things. On the other hand, when institutions get involved, then really the question of, you know, when that manuscript comes out and is, you know, they actually ask you to bid on it, it really does make a difference whether it's from the 16th century or not. If somebody, it's one thing for Pessoa to write as Alvaro de Campos, and there is no such person, but if somebody discovers a manuscript in Lisbon and says, oh, we've discovered a whole novel that Pessoa wrote as de Campos, and then it's really a matter of great concern whether or not that's true. Did Pessoa really write it? So when institutions are involved, when any kind of when the work of art goes from the privacy of a reader reading it into any kind of public realm, and institutions are that interface, I think, between the privacy of consuming art and the publicity of verifying that the art is what it is. Then the old questions of counterfeit really come back with a vengeance. And it's charming when Kenneth Rexroth, the poet, writes a series of love poems as the female Japanese poet Marichiko, and talks about his, you know, moist petals, etc. That people can accept, whether you can applaud Rexroth's courage or you can excoriate his sexism, whatever. But it's a known aesthetic fact. But when one third of the Van Goghs turn out to be fake, their detectives come out, and it's a matter of truth and fiction, good and bad, right and wrong.
Maybe yes. I think I'd be tempted to oppose precisely the two genres. Like painting, we know, is the place where you would find most fakes. Corot, as we know, has, I think, painted 3,000 paintings, out of which 8,000 are in the U.S. he would often sign, he would add his own signature to paintings done by his students. But, of course, the money involved there makes it something completely different. And, indeed, the literary fake is generally not for issues of betraying the credulity or getting some money, but creating something that is a meditation on the power at times of imagination, simply the imagination inventing things when they look they are too good to be true or they flatter the taste. I was thinking, for instance, and this was one of the characters who really interested me in my book, former student of the university, Stephen Glass. I don't know whether you've seen this film called Shattering Glass that I found really excellent, based upon the career of this journalist who started out actually as a journalist on the Daily Pennsylvanian, right here, and who, as far as I know, didn't fake his reports when he wrote for the Daily Pennsylvanian. But as soon as he started being a sort of celebrity in D.C., working for Nation and various political magazines, started inventing stories, and he was not the first, but he was the best, obviously. There had been Janet Cook and Jason Blair, but fundamentally, Glass was the best in the sense that he knew very well how the system worked. He had, for instance, a very damaging piece on Vernon Jordan, whom he accused of having sex with minors and so on, without any foundation, which damaged at that time a little bit Jordan's credibility. And then when he was asked, why did you make up this story? Don't you like him? Is it because he's African American? No, I like him a lot. But it sounded credible. It sounded like a good story, and I felt I could write it. So, of course, the difference, and this is in contradistinction to the market of the fakes, when you have all these sale at Sotheby's and so on, millions can be involved, but in the matter of the literary fake or the invention, what is at stake is the trust linking a certain public and a certain institution, that is the journal, the magazine that aims at being as accurate as possible, and then that has to fight against the damage that has been done. And it was the case with Glass. They had not only to apologize, but also to verify everything. And if you read, and I must warn you that it's not a very good novel, but Stephen Glass wrote a novel about what happened to him called The Fabulator. It's surprisingly dull, given the fact that he's an excellent writer.
And I think he's good at making up things.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
He was very good when he could play between reality and his invention. He would never invent completely. In some cases, he invented everything. But generally, he would blend carefully, and it took a long time before he was found. Of course, he knew that he sooner or later would be caught. But in The Fabulator, what is the most interesting part is that He shows how to fake it. He shows how to write a journalistic text that will pass in any magazine, journal, and so on, and that how you can step by step invent references, and he would go to quite an extent, inventing credit cards, addresses, websites even, to buttress his affirmations. But do you agree that somehow there's a real difference here between the literary fake and the, let's say, the fake Van Gogh, the fake Cole?
Well, yeah, no, there certainly is when it's a question of, when money is involved, I think that it simplifies things enormously. But a couple of different examples come up in the verbal literary realm that really, one, and this is a little bit, this is, a, I guess, a simpler problem, so I'll say it first, but then the second one is a complicated one that really speaks to what you're saying. But the first one, maybe a number of you know this, the Education of Little Tree, anybody with kids in the right age would maybe have read that book to their child. It was a very popular kids' book, very uplifting book about a child whose, I think it was his grandfather, was Native American, and the child had various, you know, had sort of tough times, was sometimes in an orphanage, sometimes sort of scrambling along, and the grandfather would always sort of come back into the narrative and establish real moments of courage and clarity and work things out in a way that was very based on a very laudatory sense of Native American culture. So it was a very, you know, PC, uplifting kind of book, and it was quite well written as well. And it came out about 10 years after publication that the person who wrote Education of Little Tree was not the grandson of Native American, but was in fact a former speechwriter for George Wallace, and was this, you know, had this real, you know, sort of disgusting racist history. And the book, it didn't, you know, the words on the page of the book didn't change. But many people felt very betrayed and sullied and confused by it. I mean, is it compensatory? Is it was he being sarcastic? Is he just a completely amoral person who is good with words and can use his ability either to craft phrases for a segregationist or sing the praises of intuitional natural life. So that's one question where it's not exactly money, but the origin of the words seems to be very important. I don't know what, you know, that's really, especially in fiction, there's a lot of those cases. There's the Romanian woman in Australia who won an award about 10, 15 years ago, but she won it as a Aboriginal author. But it turns out she's, again, a sort of a, you know, a little, there's a little hint of neo-Nazi-dom, and she's from, her family's from Romania or something. And again, a very bad, you know, the source just completely contradicts what the novel is saying. Anyway, but here's a thinking about Glass and why he's a good fabulator of stories in the nation and a mediocre novelist. There's something about the charge of lying when you're somehow in a junior position, and you have a podium that's a platform that's authoritative, but you are not fully authoritative, but you're somehow in that position. What I'm trying to say is this, that, I mean, it's this young guy going from the Daily Pennsylvanian to an established newspaper. I mean, it's a special thrill, I think, in lying in that new, big, quote-unquote, grown-up circumstance. And here's another fraud that I have to give you a lot of background. I think most of you won't know this, but There's Frank O'Hara, the New York School poet. Most of you have heard of Ashbery. O'Hara was Ashbery's really good buddy, and a great American poet, died in 1966. That's first generation New York School. There were a couple of young poets who came to New York, actually from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ted Berrigan, Ron Padgett, Joe Brainard was in that group as well. And they quickly idolized what became known as the New York School, O'Hara especially. And they're the second generation New York School. And they were very interested in their mode often was pastiche and quoting and a very kind of a coterie, very, very funny, sarcastic a sampling of other texts. And Berrigan did one thing once. He concocted an interview with John Cage, who would be more or less in the same generation as O'Hara, as from the young Ted Berrigan's point of view, an established artist with a lot of cultural capital. And so he makes up this interview just out of whole cloth, and it's between, so the speakers are Ted and John Cage, and Ted will ask John Cage, what do you think about sex? And John Cage will snap back at him, I really don't want to talk about it. My mother used to tie me up naked in bed and then lie down on top of me, but don't ask me any more about this, I really don't want to say. And so it was full of things like that, very very lively, very inventive, say, right? And in fact, it's published, I think it was in Culture magazine, edited by Lita Hornick, a socialite in New York. And it won an award for the best interview in some milieu. And I think he got, in the 60s, a substantial amount of money. In the hundreds. And John Cage, who is, of course, I hope most of you know, was an artist who was thoroughly imbued with a Zen approach to things, in which one sound isn't better than another, and one configuration isn't better than another, and therefore one set of words shouldn't be of more interest than another set of words. Was extremely upset by this, and Berrigan eventually retracted it. But it seems like, I guess, what I'm all of this. I mean, besides it's an amusing story, it's that sense of it being very exciting to lie when you are somehow speaking to an older, more authoritative, prestigious generation. I mean, the glass thing seems exactly like that. So I don't know if that's always one of the edges that brings out the need to fabulate.
I think that's a little the link between what we recognize as the right for certain writers to invent creatively. From a French point of view, there was a famous case of Marguerite Duras, who was at the, let's say, apex of her career, who covered a very famous crime in which it was possible that a mother had killed a child who had been taken from his family, and another family was accused. And without knowing much, it just gone there, she said, yes, she did it. And of course, everybody said, ah, but this is by Marguerite Duras. So it was felt as non-journalistic, even though it was in Libération, which is a very, common newspaper. But at the same time, if you read this under the pen of a poet in a literary magazine, you can assume that this is okay. Whereas if you read The Nation or New Statesman and so on, there you expect the group, the editors and so on, and they indeed control, check the facts and so on. And when you are caught, or when you catch somebody inventing, then you feel that your trust has been betrayed. But it's something that I've noted writing about many, many cases of, say, good liars, bad liars, successful liars, that It's a real paradox, and I think it has to do with literature. And there is a very interesting writer who is also a therapist, Lauren Slater. I don't know whether you know her name. She has a book called Lying, precisely. But more recently, she was really accused by a number of scientists. She, her latest book was called Skinner's Box, and she pretended that she had interviewed the Skinner's relatives, and in fact she hadn't. And part of her book, in some cases, is that she fakes certain diseases, being a psychiatrist herself, and then shows that the doctors are a little silly not to have found her out. And of course, people reacted against this as being a non-ethical gesture. But my general point is this, that at least insofar as the act of lying is concerned, it's really the place of paradox, because we all know that we all lie all the time, if not all the time. At least there have been calculations that we produce, say, 10 lies a day or so. Small lies or big lies, depending. You know, and somebody says, how do you like my new clothes? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. We lie like that. But at the same time, we do not want to be caught lying, and we do not want to catch other people lying. So there's this constant double standard, which to my French eyes is a little like the situation of prostitution, maybe more in a French context, where we know it exists. At the same time, we say this is very bad, but we accept it, but nobody really takes any measures because, yes, humanity is like that, and so on.
That's one reason I think that Bush, one of the reasons that Bush got elected is that it's to really, for enough people to really admit that this is a serial liar in the White House. I mean, it would be a very, very traumatic, actually, too traumatic, I think, for many voters, and better to just to applaud his stick-to-itiveness. Mm-hmm.
I think in the case of Bush, I think he, being a liar, which I'm sure he was, his strategy was very, very simple and worked fantastically, was to show that he was too dumb to lie. Because you assume, and I think this was because of Clinton, Clinton was seen as a little too smart, clever,
slick. He's slick, a salesman.
And a liar because he would talk too much, finish his sentences, which is always a symptom of something.
Of really dishonesty.
And Bush managed, and one can see this very well from the first debates with Gore and so on, by pretending to be more dumb than he actually is. And I don't think he is such an idiot, and would therefore appear somebody who is below the IQ needed to be a good liar. It's a very subtle strategy, which worked, I think.
I just want to go back to the point about the interview and with Ted Berrigan and John Cage. There's something that literary, it's an odd literary genre, the interview, because it really does purport to be real life. And yes, there's imaginary conversations, you know, that Pound writes or Lander writes imaginary conversations. But the real appetite is for real conversations. You really want to know, what, you know, if there were, and there wouldn't have been, right, an interview with Beckett, or there very few. I mean, you would really want to know, well, what is this guy really like? So the interview does really trade on authenticity, and that's why, I mean, it should have been obvious, I think, to the readers that Cage, that this was a made-up interview. On the other hand, Cage was such an odd, mercurial figure that perhaps, in fact, you know, Berrigan had intuited a deep, dark truth about him that nobody else knew. So there was, it was really hard to judge, but no, the interview, there is this real appetite to get behind the creative, playful, obscure literary figure to, how do you do it? Do you sharpen your pencils? Do you write standing up and authenticity is very much desired, I think, in interviews. Not so much in, well, in some literature, but in all interviews, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is, you know, for Adorno, authenticity was this myth by which he tried to catch Heidegger, in his famous attack on Heidegger and the Jargon und der Eigentlichkeit. Well, authenticity may not be exactly the best translation, but this is the standard English translation of Eigentlichkeit. And I think what we see is that certain cultures are more tolerant for lies and fakes than others. If we think back to the Greek culture of the classical times, the hero was Ulysses, who was lying all the time, even to a goddess at some point. And even at the end, when he's managed to kill all the suitors, he sees his father and he continues lying. When he has
I know, that's always that's a really incredible moment, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you wonder, why would he stop? No, it's really, obviously, and since you quoted Plato, Plato is often reputed for having banned poets away from the polis, from the city, because they are liars. But at the same time, he wrote a wonderful little dialogue, Hippias Minor, in which he says that it is better to be a liar than to be like Achilles, somebody who changes his mind all the time and looks like he doesn't know what he's saying, which is, I think, as you said, Bush versus
so
Clinton.
So Plato would vote for Clinton,
yeah,
not Bush.
Clinton, yeah. And Bush can be figured out in these very classical terms. But according to Plato, Clinton is better than Bush, which is a little paradoxical because Plato was a sort of quasi-fascist. But the idea being that it's better to lie, because in order to lie, you need to know two things. You need to know the truth and what you are inventing. As we know, to be a good liar, you need first to have a good memory, because you need to remember what you said to so-and-so, so as not to contradict yourself. So even at the level of memory, you keep these two discourses parallel. They can overlap a little bit, because you shouldn't be too far from reality. But if you invent, you will know two things. And for Plato, it's much better to know two things than just one. So in that sense, the liar is the thinker from the start. It's the man of interiority and of several polymetis, as Ulysses is called. That is, he has cunning, and who has cunning has reason, and more than reason.
Well, here's an example of a case of where you have truth and lies of a person, or in this case, two people who know two things, but it falls out differently. This is, I don't know how many of you know it's a famous hoax in the 20th century. The Australian poet Ern Malley. There was a magazine in Australia in 1940s. It was basically a very conservative literary environment with great suspicion of European imports like T.S. Eliot and Surrealism, which from the Australian point of view, they were more or less the same thing. Both were bad, and they were not to be brought into Australia. And there was one magazine there edited by Max Harris, who was a devotee of this decadent European stuff. The magazine was Angry Penguins. And remember, penguins aren't so far away from Australia. It's not quite a strange name. But the two of the most literate poets in Australia, the most educated, accomplished poets, set out to create a hoax to discredit Max Harris and Angry Penguins, and they got together, and they claim, whether it's a lie or not, they claim that in 8 hours they wrote the life work of Ern Malley, which was 30 poems, some of them almost 50 lines long, none of them shorter than, say, 12 or 15. I mean, it's really a pretty substantial body of work. They alternated lines back and forth. They quoted from army manuals about suppression of mosquitoes. They tried really hard to not make sense, and so they got these poems. Then they the best part was they got the thing that really made it work was they wrote a letter from the sister of this imaginary Erin Malley, Ethel Malley, who was a kind of a Philistine, a close-minded Philistine, who had this odd brother, and she didn't understand this poetry, and he had since died of Graves' disease, and so she's sending it on to this magazine. She wonders if it's any good. So she was very skeptical of this poetry, but her character was very well written, and so that somehow helped authenticate the manuscript. And Max Harris and other people in the magazine were overjoyed that Australia had finally produced its own homegrown modernist. And they turned over the entire issue of Angry Penguins to the work of Erin Malley, and they the painter Noland, I forget his first name, Kenneth Noland, did a cover. He painted Erin Malley on the cover. And so there's, you know, trumpeted, you know, the work of the late Erin Malley. Then after a few weeks, it came out that this was a hoax, and these two people admitted that they had written this gibberish in 8 hours, and that it was a complete send-up. And there you have the two poets, Stewart and Macaulay. They knew two things. They knew the truth, and they knew the lie. I mean, they wrote this stuff. So they, but on the other hand, they actually didn't know their own lie. They thought that the lie was ridiculous, risible, complete nonsense. And it turns out that over the decades, that people are much more interested in the work of Erin Malley. And if you turn to the, you know, you get the latest big anthologies of Australian poetry, Erin Malley's work will be in there, and the work of Stewart and Macaulay, who were you know, remained poets and wrote books, are not in there. So they didn't know their own lie. They didn't get it.
So I wonder whether the reason, you know, the other example is McPherson, Ossian, Totally Invented. But good liars, and I would include Stephen Grass, this is why he was so good at it, catch the zeitgeist very well, even though they may have other intentions. I'm thinking, for instance, of this, for theoreticians, famous so-called hoax.
Oh, the so-called hoax. Yeah.
So-called, yeah. Who parodied a number of writers, including our former colleague Arkady Pranitsky, in a text that he sent as serious to show that...
Toward the hermeneutics of quantum gravity.
To show fundamentally that matter and physics were just social constructions. So right. This was the text that was obviously ridiculously written and absurd and so on. He sent it to the editor of... the social text who teaches at New York, in NYU, and this got published. This is what he wanted, clearly, in order to create a scandal, saying, you see, this text means nothing, they don't even read the text I publish, or they just think that when you have the right names in the footnotes, it's enough, and so on, which I think can be accepted as fair game, why not, but created quite a controversy the, you know, this campaign against a French theory or some kind of theory. It's a good use, after all. I'm not against it. I find it personally relatively funny and not unethical. It's a little the limit.
Mean. It's a little mean.
Little mean. A yeah. little mean. Yeah.
But you know, but there, see, there's expertise is at stake, and Sokol is a physicist at NYU, and he has expertise. He is a physicist. He has a PhD. He authenticates other people's knowledge. And he was especially incensed at the use of Lacan and others of of mathematical analogies, Lacan's use of topology and things like that. For Sokol, this is a fraud that he didn't have this expertise, and therefore for Lacan to use this was I think Sokol would say unethical would be too strong, but it was ridiculous and needed to be challenged. And he could write a piece about physics as an expert that he could authenticate, guarantee that this was inexpert, non-expert. This is non-expert physics. This is bogus. This is pataphysical physics, so to speak. But in literature, what Stewart and Macaulay, the hoaxers in Australia, tried to do when they created Ern Mali, they tried to write poetry that was absolutely inexpert and had no raison d'etre, was meaningless. But in art, there isn't the criteria for expertise don't hold still, and transrational metaphors that the surrealists use, when used in sufficient number and when there's enough of an audience, a convention develops, or a sense that this is, you know, Breton is an expert, that this is valid art. And so it is in art, it is as if 2 and 2 is 4 in the 18th century, but by the 1920s, 2 and 2 and 4 is actually one of the least expert, quote unquote, you know, 2 and 2 is 4, is in a poetic context. That's like such old hat, it's meaningless, and in fact, two and two is anything but four becomes the new expertise in some kinds of modernism, et cetera. So there's the target, there's no, it's a moving target of expertise, whereas in physics, to say that, I think as Sokol does at the beginning of the article, that time and space have no meaning, or there's some basic things he said that I showed to a poet friend of mine who also knew physics, and he read about two sentences and he just, you know, he said, "Oh, this is obviously bullshit."
Yeah.
But the obviously bullshit in the artistic worlds, it's in fact what is obviously bullshit that is the not all the time, but enough of the time is the next good thing. So, you know, Lichtenstein, pop art, Andy Warhol, all sorts of things that are, you know, obviously bullshit, quickly become authoritative.
Yeah, I think this crisis in confidence is also often a crisis in competence. That is, if you think the experts can be deluded and cannot recognize something like that, then it means that there is a problem, that you are in such a position that anything can go. But at least for me, I would tend to make a difference between what Sokol did in that paper, which I think is an interesting weapon, it's a sort of weapon of satire.
Yeah,
you send something that is gibberish, if it is published, the other camp is silly. And what he did when he tried in the more serious text, the book called Fashionable Nonsense, when he, for instance, with respect to Lacan, he tries to show that Lacan doesn't know what he's talking about, and there he's simply wrong. And it's because there, I think, his own... Why can I say that he's wrong? That the fact that Lacan worked, you could say that he knew certain things via a number of friends who were mathematicians, but at least when he uses certain terms like the square root of minus one, Lacan knew exactly what it was, that it was an imaginary number, and he needed it for his theory. So it's a little...
It's a decorative metaphor, say.
Right, it's a sort of metaphor that allows him to conceptualize certain things, which I think is obviously accepted. Every philosopher, every thinker uses images, metaphors, and if you start refusing this, then you cannot even think or talk. So what is absurd there is to admit that so-called definition of science is the only one and is restricted to what he knows basically in physics and a few hard sciences. So I think there is a sort of distinction. But I think it's important to talk about these issues, because if one thinks philosophically via Plato or via any other important thinker, could be Heidegger or Derrida or people like that, one sees that this is the root of the paradox that, from what I've read, and I'm not a specialist in logical theory, but the expression "I lie" is the root of all the paradoxes that are really paradoxes. There are many paradoxes, and as you may know, Russell and others will exploit the paradox of the set that contains all the set that do not contain themselves, and so on. But fundamentally, they can all be reduced to that fundamental sentence, "I lie," in Greek, the pseudos.
Pseudo.
Meaning that I lie, but I tell the truth when I lie, but when I lie, I don't tell the truth, and so on. So, as the root of paradox, it's also the root of a certain kind of scientificity, since scientificity, especially mathematics, has progressed by the exploitation of these paradoxes and by trying to find resolutions to the paradoxes.
I'm just thinking about what you just said about Sokol and fashionable nonsense. What doesn't get shaken in all of these controversies are the boundaries of various disciplines. So Sokol wins when he gets his gibberish published in Social Texts, History of Philosophy of Science issue, because they can't recognize, as philosophers, they can't recognize gibberish. Mm-hmm. But when he tries to generalize his scientific knowledge to cover philosophy and psychology, he's out of his field, and therefore he's no longer the expert. Mm-hmm. And so what those boundary lines seem to be very difficult to trouble or disturb or shake. And I'm just, I guess that gets us, I mean, I was also thinking as you were talking about in terms of expertise in art, it would be very, I think it's an interesting question to ask, well, how could there be on the one hand, there's hoaxes all the time in the art world. I mean, forgeries and non-Vermeers and non-Corots, etc. So that's sort of cut and dried matter of detection and provenance. But what could be done that would really not count as art? Hmm. I mean, could you it seems to be given a field where transgression breakthrough and frame breaking is the norm, what would count as what would fail that test? Well, I mean, it's sort of interesting art problem. How you could make something that's not.
For me, it would be both a philosophical problem and, let's say, an aesthetic problem. And this is the situation someone like Nietzsche puts us in. Nietzsche is well known for having, in On Truth and Lies, in an extra-moral sense, the whole world is a lie, these are just fictions, and this is something that has been heavily recirculated in what was called postmodernism. Everything was a construction, there are better and worse fictions. The danger is that the main narrative has collapsed. We have only minor narratives, micro-narratives, not the big narrative of, say, Marxism and so on. I think we have abandoned that paradigm. And rereading, at least for me, it was curious, since I had kept this image of Nietzsche as the philosopher of there is no truth, and Plato, the philosopher of truth, I realized that they had completely exchanged their positions, that Nietzsche was completely nostalgic for truth, and he finds it in the body, wherever, whereas Plato has this interesting aristocratic cynicism and no truth when you know that it is a lie is better than the truth, even for his politics, since there is the idea of the noble lie in the Republic, the noble lie, and it is interesting in view of today's politics is the idea that the younger generations, the children of the Republic, have to believe that they were all born of one single father and mother. From a Freudian point of view, it means
they
generalized
the
incest.
They are the primal horde?
Yeah, well, it means this idea of they are autochthonous. Uh-huh. They come from the earth. So all the others are not autochthonous, they are foreigners, but those from the city, and this is a lie from the start. So in Plato, this very reactionary, quasi-fascist, again, politics is based upon a lie, a deliberate falsification, because that has to be inculcated to the young children until they really believe it. But I think, I don't know whether you would agree with me, that in that sense, this philosophical debate has been replayed in what we call modernism, when you pointed out the use of quotes, quotations, intertextuality, everything is this quotation. I think we have gone back to that, and we have passed through the moment when we thought with the post-moderns and so on that everything was a fiction. Now we know that this is not true, but everything is perhaps a quotation, which is not exactly the same.
Well, I think for everything to be a quotation, certainly in poetry, but also in sampling, in contemporary music, it's very different than a John Cagean sense of all sounds are equal. Mm. Actually, and we were in undergrad class the other day, a student I thought made a very interesting point that would the ideal listener for John Cage be somebody who just had a cochlear implant and had never, and so didn't yet have any conventions for recognizing and sorting out sounds the way we all do? Would that be the perfect Cagean listener who would really register all sonic impulses? Whereas with sampling or with quotation, we're really it's all predicated on an instantaneous literacy. I mean, not that you know exactly where it's from, but oh, I see, that's that kind of music, or oh, that's Latin, or that seems to be from the church, or that seems to be from an ad. I mean, that it's predicated on a very finely tuned cultural and historical map, and certainly sampling. I mean, I guess it's hip hop artists will sample, I don't know what, you know, Dionne Warwick or something. I mean, it would, you know, that's meant exactly to be heard, is that, and not
right.
My cultural quotation there is really off because I don't really know this music, but I know that the sampling is often very aggressive and sarcastic and complex, but it's really based on that the ear knows what it is.
Mm.
So it's very different than there is no originary, that everything is flowing
yeah.
free. Everything is really anchored in this contestatory history.
Or maybe it corresponds to a certain state of today's technology, that whether with images or with sounds, we know that we have machines that can collect all the images, more or less, that can be had in the world, all the sounds, and that there are so many sounds that it's a little idle to just try and take a violin or a guitar and produce a new sound, because this sound is already there. In the same way with the images, you could take, of course, a photograph of someone different, but you have so many photographs on the web that you can play with all these new programs with mosaics. I've seen this recently. A number of European artists ask people to send them photographs, and with these new programs, they do mosaics. There was a series on the Courbet's The Origin of the World, quite a scandalous painting, but
the Lacan can, owned, right?
Yeah, yeah. Lacan, the painting of this woman, genitals. But you send photographs, and they are immediately put somewhere in this enormous mosaic of this woman's body, and are finding the exact shade and so on. So I think it's a little bit to return to the concept of echolalia. This is indeed a certain echolalia of culture, and because you have that, there is, I think, the idea that nevertheless we do not have to believe that everything is a fiction or everything is just one narrative and that there are better and worse narratives. I think that kind of postmodern illusion, I don't know whether you would agree with me, and maybe we could ask, take a few questions.
But I just want to say one more thing, and then we really should open it up to questions. But I'm reminded of Google, which I think has changed aesthetics tremendously, because in all this conversation we've been having, I think you could say that originally lying, imaginary, the made up, the fantastic, that is predicated on a very finite known world, and the ability to lie, to imagine, to make something up, suddenly gives you, on the one hand, some sort of riches, or it expands things, and if you're a more mercantile type, well, it floods the market and with counterfeit money, perhaps. But nevertheless, you have a finite situation, and then lying, the imaginary, etc., opens things up and makes it bigger. But now, with Google or with other things like that, the given world, the world that we live in, is more or less infinite and instantaneously retrievable. And so we are all, instead of living in Ithaca, in a finite, all too finite realm, all too knowable, all too predictable, same realm, we're now living in a fully accessible infinity, and it's very, there's all sorts of new problems and desires and lacks that arise from that, but it's completely different. And therefore, the fictional actually is put under tremendous pressure right now. And it strikes me, look, I'm a poet and I don't read novels and what do I know, but it strikes me that the fictional is now put under tremendous pressure, and it's kind of weak to tell a novel, tell a story, to write a novel. There's much more desire toward a kind of a reality show. Or, I mean, it's more surprising, complex, memoir, unpredictable. Fiction seems very, Hollywood fiction is about the most boring thing there is right now. So
the genre of the biography, the memoir, explodes, and novels fall really, become historical novels. I agree.
Well, we should see if there's any comments, questions.
We have 5-10 minutes for questions if you want to ask questions.
I'll begin with two questions. So
I have two questions. One, to return to this notion of the ethics of lying. I think in the last, say, 10 years or so, there's been this huge development of institutions, cultural institutions, which are repositories of practices which are remarkably cunning and duplicitous. One,
like slot, you mean? And
so one, elevating the institution to kind of a provocation or a provocateur kind of position. The other, kind of the Museum of Jurassic Technologies model, where it's less a provocation than an unreliable kind of institutional model, which would be the complete antithesis of this kind of cliched critique of the establishment as, always purporting to be true. And the museum never lies, it educates. And so this kind of patrician notion of the cultural institution as imparting truth to its audience. So one, I'm interested in that question. That returning to that institutional model, which you guys had suggested, you weren't supposed to lie on the institutional level. Could you nevertheless have an institutional practice which was duplicitous, so as to ultimately provoke and engage audiences in a different way. And the other question would be, kind of when you had mentioned Nietzsche, I was thinking of Nietzsche and kind of, you know, an upcoming exhibit here of a video artist, a Viennese actionist, kind of an extreme form of performance art in Nietzsche's case, which involves kind of orgiastic blood rituals and classical performances within which are conveyed kind of the, you know, the using dead animal carcasses to desecrate the body and to organize these kind of fascistic kind of communal practices. So I guess, is there an ethics of such cunning practices on the artistic level, not just where it becomes indecent, but where it becomes kind of almost a problem of sorts? So those would be my two questions.
Those are big questions. Could I simplify that last question to the schematic one of when is it possible that there just is a when is something like truly problematic and unethical, unsavory in artistic practice? Unethical, say, in artistic practice? Is that one way of?
I mean, there are many, many questions, and it would be, of course, enormous to answer to all of this. But I'd like to use a distinction that I find very useful for me, at least, even though I didn't use it in that book, which is that made by Austin between performatives and constatives. I don't know whether you know what Austin is saying, but basically he's opposing the few sentences that perform, that how to do things with words.
I pronounce you man and wife. Right. I christen the ship.
I open the conference. I marry you, and so on. From all the other sentences that he calls constative, that say whether, let's say, this room is full, this room is empty, and so on. This room has an echo, this room has no echo. And what he says is that truth and falsity only apply to constatives, because in the case of a performative, you can say, you're not a priest, or you're not a rabbi, you cannot marry you, but it's not exactly the same as to say, this room, no, you said that the room was empty, it is full. See what I mean? So I think if one follows this broad distinction, an institution is much more, for me, something that wields power, therefore is on the side of a performative. It does something, therefore is not really something that could be put on the side of truth or false. And you can say that some institutions have certain aims and certain sources of financing and so on, but I don't think that you could say fundamentally that an institution can lie. I think it would not apply. That's the category distinction that I would make here, at least. And in that sense, you can of course talk in political or legal terms of what is the condition or possibility for a given institution in a given context. And that is, I think, an interesting legal discussion. But as we know, in legal discourse, the issue is very rarely truth or falsity, but it is conviction. Or more generally, in American legal discourse, the idea is to sow doubt in the minds of a number of people who think they can accuse or condemn to death, but can be shown that, well, there is a doubt, and so on, which, as a few of my friends who are lawyers would say, has very little to do with what they think the real truth is. But because they are, say, the lawyer defending a client, they have to play the performative. You see what I mean? As a lawyer, you can decide, well, I will never defend somebody who I know is guilty of murder, or I will do it because I think it is interesting but it's really a performative, if you see what I mean. So this is on the side of the institution. It's more a legal and political discourse, which I think has replaced in many, many cases the discourse about truth, the truth or non-truth of something.
Well, I'm just wondering, what about this as a question? You said an institution can't lie, and I wonder about that. What would it mean for an institution to lie? What if, I can certainly imagine a situation where you are invited to this very building in the evening to hear this discussion between these two people, and you get here and two people aren't, there's nobody here to talk. And I can imagine that kind of thing, that kind of unreliability, of creating frustration, of that kind of thing, as certainly being a performance piece. And an institution, you know, it can happen, of course. You know, if we didn't show up, then it wouldn't have been that you lied, but it would have been the promise that you made the audience would have been broken. But if you habitually did that, and if the next month's schedule, you know, you put it out on the web, and let's say, you know, you really get some big names, not like us, but, you know, Liebeskind is going to come here, and, you know, that kind of thing. You know, you're going to get Gayatri Spivak and John Travolta are going to engage in a dialogue, you know, a Coombe wrestling match or something like that. You know, that would be very exciting, and people would love to come, but nothing ever happens. Now, I don't mean to sow any ideas in your mind here, but you could only do that for a little bit of time. I mean, you could, it could be a gesture that you would make, but you couldn't make it for very long. You know, you could do it for a week or maybe even just, you know, one or two times. Whereas as a performance piece, contractual, not following through, not doing what you're saying you're doing. I mean, that's a performance strategy. Could be, certainly. So can institutions? It's like the difference between, like, institutions can't act like personal agents, like an artist can.
Yeah, I think it's not the same kind of lie. For instance, there was this very good book just published. When presidents lie, about American history, showing that almost all of American presidents have lied, and horribly, for various reasons and so on. But it begins with this example that was indeed a totally bizarre white lie when Chernobyl, I don't know whether this rings a bell, but this nuclear plant in Ukraine had exploded. There was.
I can't remember who was president. Carter, Reagan.
At that time, who was it? Reagan, maybe. But it was. I'm talking about
the Russian,
the Russian and the French and the Germans and so on. Every country said that the cloud, the radioactive cloud, had not crossed their borders. So there's this impossible situation where you had a cloud that had vanished and so on. But everybody knew it could not be the case. But everybody knew that this was a lie. That,
well, how many people are this everybody? I mean,
right. But let's say it was in all the newspapers and all the
radio columnists
televisions.
Report what the president said, and then the columnists would write, well, of course, this is
to reassure
not true.
The populations.
Nobody debunked it in print.
No, and nobody ever in Germany, in Russia. I don't know exactly where this cloud went, but it went somewhere. But everybody agreed that it was understandable, and so everybody was a sort of an accomplice in this lie that, yes, for the sake of the others, we should believe in the lie, even if we know that it is a lie. And I think this is a little...
That's a noble lie. You don't want chaos and death to ensue from...
Right.
But
that's not a lie.
That would be. I mean, there's certain kinds of masquerades. Now, isn't it like in some clubs where it's never announced, but you know, Taj Mahal sits in and plays and stuff like that. I mean, it would actually have to. You know, on the surface, you could be lying, but then quickly, if it worked, you're. Audience, the insiders would know that's the game that was being played, and then there would be a sort of differential of who understood the game, and then there would be others who would be intrigued by the thought that maybe there is a game, and they might learn about that game, or not know there'd be a boundary of initiation about that game, and in a way a whole lot of the unreliable and the lying, etc., is that kind of initiatory game, whereas the out and out hoax I think is really meant to teach people a lesson, and like, well, it's not a game, this is fake, this is true, the expert, these guys are wrong, this is right. It's different than that. The kind of thing you're talking about is, it's like it could be like a style, and it could lead to actually a new convention, and it would become true to people. Like, oh, that's how you do it if it caught on. See, I don't know if I'm.
Well, fraud, where the whole engagement is brought by this, am I being lied to or not? The question is constantly there. And I don't know if you can comment on that. It seems to be a trend and sort of dominant mode.
Yeah, but I think we are, it's like this idea that the Freudian explanations do not work anymore, because if we are told, aha, you want to sleep with your mother and kill your father, we just laugh. If we say...
Been there, done that?
Yeah. If we hear it's possible that the CIA is not lying, it's aha, no, please, we know that all the distortions and so on, Che Guevara was killed by a Colombian, he was killed by an American, and so on. I mean, all these state lies we sort of expect today. So we know at the same time that if you work with the CIA, you will create these lies. So we know that the truth of the institution is to create lies. So at this level, it's almost inscribed in the status when you are a counter-terrorist organization. Okay, yes, clearly. And we don't think that any secret service in the world will tell the truth. We know it's part of the game. So at this level, it's more levels of performativity. One of my brothers worked on the secret services of the Palestinians and the Israelis, and you know, they both sides did horrible, dirty tricks and so on, and there is no feeling of outrage because it's a certain war that uses all the disguises, secrets and so on. But this is part of a certain performative again. Some of these lies or tricks work, others don't, for various reasons. It's very hard to say. But this is why I think you cannot, in a way, reproach to that kind of institution, if it is an institution, that it has lied. See, it generates lies among its effects as weapons, that is certainly sure. But I think in terms of curators or any artistic institution, a lie is very often a breach in the trust, and it's very suicidal. Any institution that is caught in a lie is often opening a very, very deep foundational crisis. I'm thinking, for instance, of the French army during the Dreyfus affair. Their silly obstination against Dreyfus, who was clearly innocent, in the name of the values of the army, almost ruined the French army. It took two generations to reach that, but it was done. Maybe, but you know, I think for me, not being a postmodern, I think there is a way of verifying certain things, and I think I was really surprised by the fact that Kerry didn't react fast and strongly to the insinuation that he might not have done what everybody said he had done in Vietnam. I have no explanation why he decided, or his advisors decided, to act as if it was so obviously a lie that everybody would know the truth, whereas I think it was generally construed as, well, if he doesn't shout back,
he's a little guilty.
There is something. See, this is, I think, you know, was clearly from the Bush camp and so on, but it was very damaging. And I think this is a case of language game in which, even though you can be skeptical as to truth, you have to play the game. That is, somebody say, you're a liar yourself. You have immediately to... This is part of the paradox. See, the paradox works really fully at both levels. That is, we can know that we all lie once in a while, but nevertheless, you have to retaliate immediately. And I don't know what you think, but this is a case where I think Bush himself played very, very well. Just sending a very, very obvious distortion of the truth. And, you know, I think it was Talleyrand who said, defamation is the key. There will always remain something. But if you don't shoot back, then you are indeed tainted by the lie, even though it is a lie. And even though you may think it is a lie, this is the performativity of the lie. I think in this case. And then you do like a lawyer. That is, you exploit everything you have, or things you may know are not completely true. And so much in the debates, for instance, there's this very good book by, forget his first name, Joseph Wilson, the ex-ambassador, who has written this book, The Politics of Truth, because he was one of the men, even though he was a Democrat, who had been in Africa for a long time, and he was asked to give his opinion as to these strange tubes that Saddam Hussein was supposed to have bought from
Niger.
So he went there and so on. And it's obvious that he also lied in certain ways. And then his wife was exposed as a CIA agent and so on. Both sides have lied. It's very, very hard to know. But I think he lied less than the Bush side. But it's clear that as soon as you are in this kind of public arena, theater, there are certain things you cannot say for various reasons, and that you will try to cover up. And if you're caught, you have to react even more. But I think fundamentally, this is my reading, although this is maybe less true of this election than the first election of Bush. I think the first election clearly was based on the strategy of really letting his dyslexia speak for him, and to show that a president who couldn't speak English correctly was therefore unable to articulate a lie. Being inarticulate was a way of showing that you couldn't lie, because in order to lie, you have to be articulate.
Well, I think that if I'm not mistaken, is it Bush who said, "I'll never lie to you"? I mean, Clinton's lie was infuriated a tremendous proportion of the population, and the cleverness of it depends on what is. I mean, that's just what your definition of is.
Yeah.
Just to have those two words is together in a sentence, that's a major problem. And you're exactly right there. It just seems like it smacks of verbalism, of theory, of Derrida, Brie, all of that. You know?
No. Clinton is a Lacanian president. He's not a Derridian president, because he said there is no sexual relation. This is what Lacan. This is what Lacan says. So this is a.
Well, you know about that, because you're a...
Well, I sort of know about that.
I mean, what's your machine's name? I forget.
Erica.
Erica, right. He's invented a palm writing machine and has gotten palms published in magazines. And
shows it. Yeah, we have this on the website. That's very interesting to see the games.
Well, I want to speak in defense of the
wire. Okay. Right.
And I would kind of argue that there's a little bit different motivation than that, right? That, you know, part of that is to expose a greater fraud, a greater lie. So, for example, if you take a walk through Chelsea and go through galleries, you see just, you know, gallery after gallery, it's almost technical perfection, but it's just a dreary, kind of sameness. I would argue that there's
Well, the narrative of avant-garde, of conventionality, it's a very multi-layered messy thing, because from my perspective, the real attack on the sclerotic fashions in art has been going on now for many decades. And right now, for me, and just listening to this, to the conversation tonight, I'm very aware of these two tracks. We talk about lies in presidential politics and geopolitics, and then there's this other smaller track of lies and hoaxes and pseudographic writing and that game playing in the artistic world. And it strikes me that the political arena, the questions are just so much bigger, and that the art strategies of deformation and playfulness and outright lying don't really have much of a purchase on Iraq right now, or on the election, or what if, you know, what I read today on the blogs, that the one machine in Broward County in Florida in fact counted backwards, and that every vote for Kerry lessened, you know, it lessened the amount of number of votes that Kerry got. Or this county in Ohio where out of 400 votes cast, 4,600 of them were for Bush. You know, that seems to be a couple of documented cases. And there, you know, everybody's ears perk up and we think, well, wait a minute. But, you know, it's absolutely crucial that we find out the truth of these voting procedures and whatever we can. And it seems like art is in a very funny place right now vis-a-vis this stuff. And so so narratives of the older, to me, older narratives of transgression only have purchase against a solid front of agreement and convention in art. And then, yes, transgression often lets, you know, in the history of art, has let in breaths of fresh air, and the really good stuff turns out to be what was transgressive. But today, in our sort of Googled, claustrophobic infinity that we live in, I don't know quite I don't have a good, quick, crisp soundbite about how art is to react to this, or art practices are to react to this. But it strikes me as a very new kind of situation, and that to me, historic models of truth and falsity, of lying, of imagination, fantasy, all of those need to be somehow, there needs to be a new slant or direction through all of that, and it isn't just going toward authenticity. Absolutely, I'm not saying that, because that seems like a pretty weak card to play for art to play right now. But what are the strong ones? I don't know.
But I'd say that, I mean, I agree with your drift that, following Plato, I think that an artist today who lies and who knows that he lies and how he lies fares better and is better off than somebody who is just naive and thinks he's original when he's not, which is often the case. So, you know, going back to Duchamp's famous gesture of signing our mat and sending the urinal from Philadelphia to the exhibition in 1917, contemporary art has been based on a series of gestures that are for a community, which can be a joke, a hoax, a real lie, a breakthrough, or a revolutionary gesture, who knows.
Well, you know, cunning. Cunning is invention, is resourcefulness, is the ability to delay, timing, all of that. And in the context of Ulysses, what's at the bedrock of all that is in fact the bed, Penelope's bed, and he's got to get back there. And remember, actually, I was thinking about when he lies to his father. Well, Ulysses, Odysseus lies. He lies to Penelope too, actually. After all the suitors are slain, it's not a Hollywood moment. He lies to her, and then she lies back to him, and she talks about the bed being moved, and that blows his cover, and he says, "Oh, you know, God damn it, you know, I made that bed with the one tree was anchored to the ground, and that bed cannot be moved, and that's the limit." To Odysseus's lying is the marriage bed, and for Penelope to imaginatively, verbally move it, that's when we get the truth. So that so Odysseus's cunning is finally to get back to this not unmoved, unviolated marriage bed. So there, it is predicated on something very. It's very unambiguously the case, very true. So it isn't an endless recess of perspectives and mirrors, etc. There's this funny bedrock, which is of course very gendered. But anyway, with Ulysses, that cunning only goes that far.
Because I think for Homer, at least in Homer's world, Metis was good. There's no doubt that cunning was good, and that among the qualifications of Odysseus, Polytropos is full of tricks, but Polymechan, he has all the arts. So it's because he has all the tricks and the tropes that he has all the arts. So. In the Greek world, and when Athena is lied to, and she just laughs. It's a great moment when she, a goddess, laughs because of a cunning trick that she says, "Ah, yes, you cannot stop, can you?" She's like that. But I think we have to stop. But thank you very much for your attention.